producer of a television news show, you would be well aware of these matters and would be careful to choose your cast on the basis of criteria used by David Merrick and other successful impresarios. Like them, you would turn your attention to staging the show on principles that maximize entertainment value. You would, for example, select a musical theme for the show. All television news programs begin, end, and are somewhere in between punctuated with music. I have found very few Americans who regard this custom as peculiar, which in fact I have taken as evidence for the dissolution of lines of demarcation between serious public discourse and entertainment. What has music to do with the news? Why is it there? It is there, I assume, for the same reason music is used in the theater and films, to create a mood and provide a leitmotif for the entertainment. If there were no music, as is the case when any television program is interrupted for a news flash, viewers would expect something truly alarming, possibly life-altering. But as long as the music is there as a frame for the program, the viewer is comforted to believe that there is nothing to be greatly alarmed about, that in fact, the events that are reported have as much relation to reality as do scenes in a play. This perception of a news show as a stylized dramatic performance whose content has been staged largely to entertain is reinforced by several other features, including the fact that the average length of any story is 45 seconds. While brevity does not always suggest triviality, in this case it clearly does. It is simply not possible to convey a sense of seriousness about any event if its implications are exhausted in less than 1 minute's time. In fact, it is quite obvious that TV news has no intention of suggesting that any story has any implications, for that would require viewers to continue to think about it when it is done, and therefore obstruct their attending to the next story that waits panting in the wings. In any case, viewers are not provided with much opportunity to be distracted from the next story, since in all likelihood it will consist of some film footage. Pictures have little difficulty in overwhelming words and short-circuiting introspection. As a television producer, you would be certain to give both prominence and precedence to any event for which there is some sort of visual documentation. A suspected killer being brought into a police station, the angry face of a cheated consumer, a barrel going over Niagara Falls with a person alleged to be in it, the president disembarking from a helicopter on the White House lawn, these are always fascinating or amusing and easily satisfy the requirements of an entertaining show. It is, of course, not necessary that the visuals actually document the point of a story, neither is it necessary to explain why such images are intruding themselves on public consciousness. Film footage justifies itself, as every television producer well knows. It is also of considerable help in maintaining a high level of unreality that the newscasters do not pause to grimace or shiver when they speak their prefaces or epilogues to the film clips. Indeed, many newscasters do not appear to grasp the meaning of what they are saying, and some hold to a fixed and ingratiating enthusiasm as they report on earthquakes, mass killings, and other disasters. Viewers would be quite disconcerted by any show of concern or terror on the part of newscasters. Viewers, after all, are partners with the newscasters in the now-this culture, and they expect the newscaster to play out his or her role as a character who is marginally serious, but who stays well clear of authentic understanding. The viewers, for their part, will not be caught contaminating their responses with a sense of reality, any more than an audience at a play would go scurrying to call home because a character on stage has said that a murderer is loose in the neighborhood. The viewers also know that no matter how grave any fragment of news may appear, for example, on the day I write, a Marine Corps general has declared that nuclear war between the United States and Russia is inevitable, it will shortly be followed by a series of commercials that will, in an instant, defuse the import of the news, in fact, render it largely banal. This is a key element in the structure of a news program, and all by itself refutes any claim that television news is designed as a serious form of public discourse. Imagine what you would think of me and this book if I were to pause here, tell you that I will return to my discussion in a moment, and then proceed to write a few words in behalf of United Airlines or the Chase Manhattan Bank. You would rightly think that I had no respect for you, and certainly no respect for the subject. And if I did this not once, but several times in each chapter, you would think the whole enterprise unworthy of your attention. Why, then, do we not think a news show similarly unworthy? The reason, I believe, is that whereas we expect books and even other media, such as film, to maintain a consistency of tone and a continuity of content, we have no such expectation of television, and especially television news. We have become so accustomed to its discontinuities that we are no longer struck dumb, as any sane person would be, by a newscaster who, having just reported that a nuclear war is inevitable, goes on to say that he will be right back after this word from Burger King, who says, in other words, now this. One can hardly overestimate the damage that such juxtapositions do to our sense of the world as a serious place. The damage is especially massive to youthful viewers who depend so much on television for their clues as to how to respond to the world. In watching television news, they, more than any other segment of the audience, are drawn into an epistemology based on the assumption that all reports of cruelty and death are greatly exaggerated and, in any case, not to be taken seriously or responded to sanely. I should go so far as to say that embedded in the surrealistic frame of a television news show is a theory of anti-communication, featuring a type of discourse that abandons logic, reason, sequence, and rules of contradiction. In aesthetics, I believe the name given to this theory is Dadaism. In philosophy, nihilism. In psychiatry, schizophrenia. In the parlance of the theater, it is known as vaudeville. For those who think I am here guilty of hyperbole, I offer the following description of television news by Robert McNeil, executive editor and co-anchor of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. The idea, he writes, is to keep everything brief, not to strain the attention of anyone, but instead to provide constant stimulation through variety, novelty, action, and movement. You are required to pay attention to no concept, no character, and no problem for more than a few seconds at a time. He goes on to say that the assumptions controlling a news show are that bite-sized is best, that complexity must be avoided, that nuances are dispensable, that qualifications impede the simple message, that visual stimulation is a substitute for thought, and that verbal precision is an anachronism. Robert McNeil has more reason than most to give testimony about the television news show as vaudeville act. The McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour is an unusual and gracious attempt to bring to television some of the elements of typographic discourse. The program abjures visual stimulation, consists largely of extended explanations of events and in-depth interviews, which even there means only 5 to 10 minutes, limits the number of stories covered, and emphasizes background and coherence. But television has exacted its price for McNeil's rejection of a show business format. By television standards, the audience is minuscule. The program is confined to public television stations, and it is a good guess that the combined salary of McNeil and Lehrer is 1/5 of Dan Rather's or Tom Brokaw's. If you were a producer of a television news show for a commercial station, you would not have the option of defying television's requirements. It would be demanded of you that you strive for the largest possible audience, and as a consequence, and in spite of your best intentions, you would arrive at a production very nearly resembling McNeil's description. Moreover, you would include some things McNeil does not mention. You would try to make celebrities of your newscasters. You would advertise the show, both in the press and on television itself. You would do news briefs to serve as an inducement to viewers. You would have a weatherman as comic relief and a sportscaster whose language is a touch uncouth as a way of his relating to the beer-drinking common man. You would, in short, package the whole event as any producer might who is in the entertainment business. The result of all this is that Americans are the best entertained and quite likely the least well-informed people in the Western world. I say this in the face of the popular conceit that television, as a window to the world, has made Americans exceedingly well informed. Much depends here, of course, on what is meant by being informed. I will pass over the now tiresome polls that tell us that, at any given moment, 70% of our citizens do not know who is the Secretary of State or the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Let us consider instead the case of Iran during the drama that was called the Iranian hostage crisis. I don't suppose there has been a story in years that received more continuous attention from television. We may assume, then, that Americans know most of what there is to know about this unhappy event. And now I put these questions to you. Would it be an exaggeration to say that not one American in 100 knows what language the Iranians speak, or what the word Ayatollah means or implies, or knows any details of the tenets of Iranian religious beliefs, or the main outlines of their political history, or knows who the Shah was and where he came from? Nonetheless, everyone had an opinion about this event, for in America, everyone is entitled to an opinion, and it is certainly useful to have a few when a pollster shows up. But these are opinions of a quite different order from 18th or 19th century opinions. It is probably more accurate to call them emotions rather than opinions, which would account for the fact that they change from week to week, as the pollsters tell us. What is happening here is that television is altering the meaning of being informed by creating a species of information that might properly be called disinformation. I am using this word almost in the precise sense in which it is used by spies in the CIA or KGB. Disinformation does not mean false information, it means misleading information, misplaced, irrelevant, fragmented, or superficial information, information that creates the illusion of knowing something, but which in fact leads one away from knowing. In saying this, I do not mean to imply that television news deliberately aims to deprive Americans of a coherent, contextual understanding of their world. I mean to say that when news is packaged as entertainment, that is the inevitable result. And in saying that the television news show entertains but does not inform, I am saying something far more serious than that we are being deprived of authentic information. I am saying we are losing our sense of what it means to be well informed. Ignorance is always correctable, but what shall we do if we take ignorance to be knowledge? Here is a startling example of how this process bedevils us. A New York Times article is headlined on February 15, 1983, "Reagan Misstatements Getting Less Attention." The article begins in the following way. President Reagan's aides used to become visibly alarmed at suggestions that he had given mangled and perhaps misleading accounts of his policies or of current events in general. That doesn't seem to happen much anymore. Indeed, the president continues to make debatable assertions of fact, but news accounts do not deal with them as extensively as they once did. In the view of White House officials, the declining news coverage mirrors a decline in interest by the general public. By italics. This report is not so much a news story as a story about the news, and our recent history suggests that it is not about Ronald Reagan's charm. It is about how news is defined, and I believe the story would be quite astonishing to both civil libertarians and tyrants of an earlier time. Walter Lippmann, for example, wrote in 1920, "There can be no liberty for a community which lacks the means by which to detect lies." For all of his pessimism about the possibilities of restoring an 18th and 19th century level of public discourse, Lippmann assumed, as did Thomas Jefferson before him, that with a well-trained press functioning as a lie detector, the public's interest in a president's mangling of the truth would be piqued in both senses of that word. Given the means to detect lies, he believed, the public could not be indifferent to their consequences. But this case refutes his assumption. The reporters who cover the White House are ready and able to expose lies, and thus create the grounds for informed and indignant opinion. But apparently the public declines to take an interest. To press reports of White House dissembling, the public has replied with Queen Victoria's famous line, "We are not amused." However, here the words mean something the Queen did not have in mind. They mean that what is not amusing does not compel their attention. Perhaps if the president's lies could be demonstrated by pictures and accompanied by music, the public would raise a curious eyebrow. If a movie like All the President's Men could be made from his misleading accounts of government policy, if there were a break-in of some sort or sinister characters laundering money, attention would quite likely be paid. We do well to remember that President Nixon did not begin to come undone until his lies were given a theatrical setting at the Watergate hearings. But we do not have anything like that here. Apparently, all President Reagan does is say things that are not entirely true, and there is nothing entertaining in that. But there is a subtler point to be made here. Many of the president's misstatements fall in the category of contradictions, mutually exclusive assertions that cannot possibly both in the same context be true. In the same context is the key phrase here, for it is context that defines contradiction. There is no problem in someone's remarking that he prefers oranges to apples, and also remarking that he prefers apples to oranges, not if one statement is made in the context of choosing a wallpaper design and the other in the context of selecting fruit for dessert. In such a case, we have statements that are opposites, but not contradictory. But if the statements are made in a single, continuous, and coherent context, then they are contradictions, and cannot both be true. Contradiction, in short, requires that statements and events be perceived as interrelated aspects of a continuous and coherent context. Disappear the context, or fragment it, and contradiction disappears. This point is nowhere made more clear to me than in conferences with my younger students about their writing. "Look here," I say, "in this paragraph you have said one thing, and in that you have said the opposite. Which is it to be?" They are polite and wish to please, but they are as baffled by the question as I am by the response. I know, they will say, but that is there, and this is here. The difference between us is that I assume there and here, now and then, one paragraph and the next, to be connected, to be continuous, to be part of the same coherent world of thought. That is the way of typographic discourse, and typography is the universe I'm coming from, as they say. But they are coming from a different universe of discourse altogether, the now-this world of television. The fundamental assumption of that world is not coherence, but discontinuity. And in a world of discontinuities, contradiction is useless as a test of truth or merit, because contradiction does not exist. My point is that we are by now so thoroughly adjusted to the now-this world of news, a world of fragments where events stand alone, stripped of any connection to the past or to the future or to other events, that all assumptions of coherence have vanished. And so, perforce, has contradiction. In the context of no context, so to speak, it simply disappears. And in its absence, what possible interest could there be in a list of what the president says now and what he said then? It is merely a rehash of old news, and there is nothing interesting or entertaining in that. The only thing to be amused about is the bafflement of reporters at the public's indifference. There is an irony in the fact that the very group that has taken the world apart should, on trying to piece it together again, be surprised that no one notices much or cares. For all his perspicacity, George Orwell would have been stymied by this situation. There is nothing Orwellian about it. The president does not have the press under his thumb. The New York Times and the Washington Post are not Pravda. The Associated Press is not TASS. And there is no newspeak here. Lies have not been defined as truth, nor truth as lies. All that has happened is that the public has adjusted to incoherence and been amused into indifference. Which is why Aldous Huxley would not in the least be surprised by the story. Indeed, he prophesied its coming. He believed that it is far more likely that the Western democracies will dance and dream themselves into oblivion than march into it single file and manacled. Huxley grasped, as Orwell did not, that it is not necessary to conceal anything from a public insensible to contradiction and narcotized by technological diversions. Although Huxley did not specify that television would be our main line to the drug, he would have no difficulty accepting Robert McNeil's observation that television is the soma of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Big Brother turns out to be Howdy Doody. I do not mean that the trivialization of public information is all accomplished on television. I mean that television is the paradigm for our conception of public information. As the printing press did in an earlier time, television has achieved the power to define the form in which news must come, and it has also defined how we shall respond to it. In presenting news to us packaged as vaudeville, television induces other media to do the same, so that the total information environment begins to mirror television. For example, America's newest and highly successful national newspaper, USA Today, is modeled precisely on the format of television. It is sold on the street in receptacles that look like television sets. Its stories are uncommonly short. Its design leans heavily on pictures, charts, and other graphics, some of them printed in various colors. Its weather maps are a visual delight. Its sports section includes enough pointless statistics to distract a computer. As a consequence, USA Today, which began publication in September 1982, has become the third largest daily in the United States, as of July 1984, according to the Audit Bureau of Circulations, moving quickly to overtake the Daily News and the Wall Street Journal. Journalists of a more traditional bent have criticized it for its superficiality and theatrics, but the paper's editors remain steadfast in their disregard of typographic standards. The paper's editor-in-chief, John Quinn, has said, "We are not up to undertaking projects of the dimensions needed to win prizes. They don't give awards for the best investigative paragraph." Here is an astonishing tribute to the resonance of television's epistemology. In the age of television, the paragraph is becoming the basic unit of news in print media. Moreover, Mr. Quinn need not fret too long about being deprived of awards. As other newspapers join in the transformation, the time cannot be far off when awards will be given for the best investigative sentence. It needs also to be noted here that new and successful magazines such as People and Us are not only examples of television-oriented print media, but have had an extraordinary ricochet effect on television itself. Whereas television taught the magazines that news is nothing but entertainment, the magazines have taught television that nothing but entertainment is news. Television programs such as Entertainment Tonight turn information about entertainers and celebrities into serious cultural content, so that the circle begins to close. Both the form and content of news becomes entertainment. Radio, of course, is the least likely medium to join in the descent into a Huxleyan world of technological narcotics. It is, after all, particularly well suited to the transmission of rational, complex language. Nonetheless, and even if we disregard radio's captivation by the music industry, we appear to be left with the chilling fact that such language as radio allows us to hear is increasingly primitive, fragmented, and largely aimed at invoking visceral response. Which is to say, it is the linguistic analog to the ubiquitous rock music that is radio's principal source of income. As I write, the trend in call-in shows is for the host to insult callers, whose language does not in itself go much beyond humanoid grunting. Such programs have little content, as this word used to be defined, and are merely of archaeological interest in that they give us a sense of what a dialogue among Neanderthals might have been like. More to the point, the language of radio newscasts has become, under the influence of television, increasingly decontextualized and discontinuous, so that the possibility of anyone's knowing about the world, as against merely knowing of it, is effectively blocked. In New York City, radio station WINS entreats its listeners to give us 22 minutes and we'll give you the world. This is said without irony, and its audience, we may assume, does not regard the slogan as the conception of a disordered mind. And so we move rapidly into an information environment which may rightly be called trivial pursuit. As the game of that name uses facts as a source of amusement, so do our sources of news. It has been demonstrated many times that a culture can survive misinformation and false opinion. It has not yet been demonstrated whether a culture can survive if it takes the measure of the world in 22 minutes, or if the value of its news is determined by the number of laughs it provides. Chapter 8. Shuffle Off to Bethlehem. There is an evangelical preacher on television who goes by the name of Reverend Terry. She appears to be in her early 50s and features a coiffure of which it has been said that it cannot be mussed, only broken. Reverend Terry is energetic and folksy, and uses a style of preaching modeled on early Milton Berle. When her audiences are shown in reaction shots, they are almost always laughing. As a consequence, it would be difficult to distinguish them from audiences, say, at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas, except for the fact that they have a slightly cleaner, more wholesome look. Reverend Terry tries to persuade them, as well as those at home, to change their ways by finding Jesus Christ. To help her do this, she offers a prosperity campaign kit, which appears to have a dual purpose. As it brings one nearer to Jesus, it also provides advice on how to increase one's bank account. This makes her followers extremely happy and confirms their predisposition to believe that prosperity is the true aim of religion. Perhaps God disagrees. As of this writing, Reverend Terry has been obliged to declare bankruptcy and temporarily halt her ministrations. Pat Robertson is the master of ceremonies of the highly successful 700 Club, a television show and religious organization of sorts to which you can belong by paying $15 per month. Of course, anyone with cable television can watch the show free of charge. Reverend Robertson does his act in a much lower register than Reverend Terry. He is modest, intelligent, and has the kind of charm television viewers would associate with a cool-headed talk show host. His appeal to godliness is considerably more sophisticated than Reverend Terry's, at least from the standpoint of television. Indeed, he appears to use as his model of communication Entertainment Tonight. His program includes interviews, singers, and taped segments with entertainers who are born-again Christians. For example, all of the chorus girls in Don Ho's Hawaiian act are born again, and in one segment we are shown them both at prayer and on stage, although not at the same time. The program also includes taped reenactments of people who, having been driven to the edge of despair, are saved by the 700 Club. Such people play themselves in these finely crafted docudramas. In one, we are shown a woman racked with anxiety. She cannot concentrate on her wifely duties. The television shows and movies she sees induce a generalized fear of the world. Paranoia closes in. She even begins to believe that her own children are trying to kill her. As the play proceeds, we see her in front of her television set chancing upon the 700 Club. She becomes interested in its message. She allows Jesus to enter her heart. She is saved. At the end of the play, we see her going about her business calmly and cheerfully, her eyes illuminated with peace. And so we may say that the 700 Club has twice elevated her to a state of transcendence. First, by putting her in the presence of Jesus. Second, by making her into a television star. To the uninitiated, it is not entirely clear which is the higher estate. Toward the end of each 700 Club show, the following day's acts are announced. They are many and various. The program concludes with someone saying, "All this and more, tomorrow on the 700 Club." Jimmy Swaggart is a somewhat older-style evangelist. Though he plays the piano quite well, sings sweetly, and uses the full range of television's resources, when he gets going, he favors a kind of fire-and-brimstone approach. But because this is television, he often moderates his message with a dollop of ecumenism. For example, his sermon on the question, "Are the Jews practicing blasphemy?" begins by assuring his audience that they are not, by recalling Jesus' bar mitzvah, and by insisting that Christians owe the Jews a considerable debt. It ends with his indicating that with the loss of their temple in biblical times, the Jews have somehow lost their way. His message suggests that they are rather to be pitied than despised, but that, in any case, many of them are pretty nice people. It is the perfect television sermon, theatrical, emotional, and in a curious way comforting, even to a Jewish viewer. For television, bless its heart, is not congenial to messages of naked hate. For one thing, you never know who is watching, so it is best not to be wildly offensive. For another, haters with reddened faces and demonic gestures merely look foolish on television, as Marshall McLuhan observed years ago and Senator Joseph McCarthy learned to his dismay. Television favors moods of conciliation and is at its best when substance of any kind is muted. One must make an exception here for those instances when preachers like Swaggart turn to the subject of the devil and secular humanism. Then they are quite uncompromising in the ferocity of their assaults, partly, one may assume, because neither the devil nor secular humanists are included in the Nielsen ratings. Neither are they inclined to watch. There are at present 35 television stations owned and operated by religious organizations, but every television station features religious programming of one sort or another. To prepare myself for writing this chapter, I watched 42 hours of television's version of religion, mostly the shows of Robert Schuller, Oral Roberts, Jimmy Swaggart, Jerry Falwell, Jim Baker, and Pat Robertson. 42 hours were entirely unnecessary. 5 would have provided me with all the conclusions, of which there are 2 that are fairly to be drawn. The first is that on television, religion, like everything else, is presented quite simply and without apology as an entertainment. Everything that makes religion an historic, profound, and sacred human activity is stripped away. There is no ritual, no dogma, no tradition, no theology, and above all, no sense of spiritual transcendence. On these shows, the preacher is tops. God comes out as second banana. The second conclusion is that this fact has more to do with the bias of television than with the deficiencies of these electronic preachers, as they are called. It is true enough that some of these men are uneducated, provincial, and even bigoted. They certainly do not compare favorably with well-known evangelicals of an earlier period, such as Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and Charles Finney, who were men of great learning, theological subtlety, and powerful expositional skills. Nonetheless, today's television preachers are probably not greatly different in their limitations from most earlier evangelicals or from many ministers today whose activities are confined to churches and synagogues. What makes these television preachers the enemy of religious experience is not so much their weaknesses, but the weaknesses of the medium in which they work. Most Americans, including preachers, have difficulty accepting the truth, if they think about it at all, that not all forms of discourse can be converted from one medium to another. It is naive to suppose that something that has been expressed in one form can be expressed in another without significantly changing its meaning, texture, or value. Much prose translates fairly well from one language to another, but we know that poetry does not. We may get a rough idea of the sense of a translated poem, but usually everything else is lost, especially that which makes it an object of beauty. The translation makes it into something it was not. To take another example, we may find it convenient to send a condolence card to a bereaved friend, but we delude ourselves if we believe that our card conveys the same meaning as our broken and whispered words when we are present. The card not only changes the words, but eliminates the context from which the words take their meaning. Similarly, we delude ourselves if we believe that most everything a teacher normally does can be replicated with greater efficiency by a microcomputer. Perhaps some things can, but there is always the question, what is lost in the translation? The answer may even be, everything that is significant about education. Though it may be un-American to say it, not everything is televisable. Or, to put it more precisely, what is televised is transformed from what it was to something else, which may or may not preserve its former essence. For the most part, television preachers have not seriously addressed this matter. They have assumed that what had formerly been done in a church or a tent and face-to-face can be done on television without loss of meaning, without changing the quality of the religious experience. Perhaps their failure to address the translation issue has its origin in the hubris engendered by the dazzling number of people to whom television gives them access. Television, Billy Graham has written, is the most powerful tool of communication ever devised by man. Each of my primetime specials is now carried by nearly 300 stations across the United States and Canada, so that in a single telecast I preach to millions more than Christ did in his lifetime. To this, Pat Robertson adds, to say that the church shouldn't be involved with television is utter folly. The needs are the same, the message is the same, but the delivery can change. It would be folly for the church not to get involved with the most formative force in America. This is gross technological naivete. If the delivery is not the same, then the message, quite likely, is not the same. And if the context in which the message is experienced is altogether different from what it was in Jesus' time, we may assume that its social and psychological meaning is different as well. To come to the point, there are several characteristics of television and its surround that converge to make authentic religious experience impossible. The first has to do with the fact that there is no way to consecrate the space in which a television show is experienced. It is an essential condition of any traditional religious service that the space in which it is conducted must be invested with some measure of sacrality. Of course, a church or synagogue is designed as a place of ritual enactment, so that almost anything that occurs there, even a bingo game, has a religious aura. But a religious service need not occur only in a church or synagogue. Almost any place will do, provided it is first decontaminated, that is, divested of its profane uses. This can be done by placing a cross on a wall or candles on a table or a sacred document in public view. Through such acts, a gymnasium or dining hall or hotel room can be transformed into a place of worship. A slice of space-time can be removed from the world of profane events and be recreated into a reality that does not belong to our world. But for this transformation to be made, it is essential that certain rules of conduct be observed. There will be no eating or idle conversation, for example. One may be required to put on a skull cap or to kneel down at appropriate moments, or simply to contemplate in silence. Our conduct must be congruent with the otherworldliness of the space. But this condition is not usually met when we are watching a religious television program. The activities in one's living room or bedroom or, God help us, one's kitchen are usually the same whether a religious program is being presented or the A-Team or Dallas is being presented. People will eat, talk, go to the bathroom, do push-ups, or any of the things they are accustomed to doing in the presence of an animated television screen. If an audience is not immersed in an aura of mystery and symbolic otherworldliness, then it is unlikely that it can call forth the state of mind required for a non-trivial religious experience. Moreover, the television screen itself has a strong bias toward a psychology of secularism. The screen is so saturated with our memories of profane events, so deeply associated with the commercial and entertainment worlds, that it is difficult for it to be recreated as a frame for sacred events. Among other things, the viewer is at all times aware that a flick of the switch will produce a different and secular event on the screen, a hockey game, a commercial, a cartoon. Not only that, but both prior to and immediately following most religious programs, there are commercials, promos for popular shows, and a variety of other secular images and discourses, so that the main message of the screen itself is a continual promise of entertainment. Both the history and the ever-present possibilities of the television screen work against the idea that introspection or spiritual transcendence is desirable in its presence. The television screen wants you to remember that its imagery is always available for your amusement and pleasure. The television preachers themselves are well aware of this. They know that their programs do not represent a discontinuity in commercial broadcasting, but are merely part of an unbroken continuum. Indeed, many of these programs are presented at times other than traditional Sunday hours. Some of the more popular preachers are quite willing to go head-to-head with secular programs because they believe they can put on a more appealing show. Incidentally, the money to do this is no problem. Contributions to these shows run into the millions. It has been estimated that the total revenue of the Electric Church exceeds $500 million a year. I mention this only to indicate why it is possible for these preachers to match the high production costs of any strictly commercial program, and match them they do. Most of the religious shows feature sparkling fountains, floral displays, choral groups, and elaborate sets. All of them take as their model for staging some well-known commercial program. Jim Baker, for example, uses the Merv Griffin Show as his guide. More than occasionally, programs are done on location in exotic locales with attractive and unfamiliar vistas. In addition, exceedingly handsome people are usually in view, both on the stage and in the audience. Robert Schuller is particularly partial to celebrities, especially movie actors like Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and Cliff Robertson, who have declared their allegiance to him. Not only does Schuller have celebrities on his show, but his advertisements use their presence to attract an audience. Indeed, I think it is fair to say that attracting an audience is the main goal of these programs, just as it is for the A-Team and Dallas. To achieve this goal, the most modern methods of marketing and promotion are abundantly used, such as offering free pamphlets, Bibles, and gifts, and in Jerry Falwell's case, two free Jesus First pins. The preachers are forthright about how they control the content of their preaching to maximize their ratings. You shall wait a very long time indeed if you wish to hear an electronic preacher refer to the difficulties a rich man will have in gaining access to heaven. The executive director of the National Religious Broadcasters Association sums up what he calls the unwritten law of all television preachers. You can get your share of the audience only by offering people something they want. You will note, I am sure, that this is an unusual religious credo. There is no great religious leader, from the Buddha to Moses to Jesus to Muhammad to Luther, who offered people what they want, only what they need. But television is not well suited to offering people what they need. It is user-friendly. It is too easy to turn off. It is at its most alluring when it speaks the language of dynamic visual imagery. It does not accommodate complex language or stringent demands. As a consequence, what is preached on television is not anything like the Sermon on the Mount. Religious programs are filled with good cheer. They celebrate affluence. Their featured players become celebrities. Though their messages are trivial, the shows have high ratings. Or rather, because their messages are trivial, the shows have high ratings. I believe I am not mistaken in saying that Christianity is a demanding and serious religion. When it is delivered as easy and amusing, it is another kind of religion altogether. There are, of course, counter-arguments to the claim that television degrades religion. Among them is that spectacle is hardly a stranger to religion. If one puts aside the Quakers and a few other austere sects, every religion tries to make itself appealing through art, music, icons, and awe-inspiring ritual. The aesthetic dimension to religion is the source of its attraction to many people. This is especially true of Roman Catholicism and Judaism, which supply their congregants with haunting chants, magnificent robes and shawls, magical hats, wafers and wine, stained glass windows, and the mysterious cadences of ancient languages. The difference between these accoutrements of religion and the floral displays, fountains, and elaborate sets we see on television is that the former are not, in fact, accoutrements, but integral parts of the history and doctrines of the religion itself. They require congregants to respond to them with suitable reverence. A Jew does not cover his head at prayer because a skull cap looks good on television. A Catholic does not light a votive candle to improve the look of the altar. Rabbis, priests, and Presbyterian ministers do not, in the midst of a service, take testimony from movie stars to find out why they are religious people. The spectacle we find in true religions has as its purpose enchantment, not entertainment. The distinction is critical. By endowing things with magic, enchantment is the means through which we may gain access to sacredness. Entertainment is the means through which we distance ourselves from it. The reply to this is that most of the religion available to us on television is fundamentalist, which explicitly disdains ritual and theology in favor of direct communication with the Bible itself, that is, with God. Without ensnaring myself in a theological argument for which I am unprepared, I think it both fair and obvious to say that on television, God is a vague and subordinate character. Though his name is invoked repeatedly, the concreteness and persistence of the image of the preacher carries the clear message that it is he, not a he, who must be worshipped. I do not mean to imply that the preacher wishes it to be so, only that the power of a close-up televised face in color makes idolatry a continual hazard. Television is, after all, a form of graven imagery far more alluring than a golden calf. I suspect, though I have no external evidence of it, that Catholic objections to Bishop Fulton Sheen's theatrical performances on television of several years back sprang from the impression that viewers were misdirecting their devotions away from God and toward Bishop Sheen, whose piercing eyes, awesome cape, and stately tones were as close a resemblance to a deity as charisma allows. Television's strongest point is that it brings personalities into our hearts, not abstractions into our heads. That is why CBS's programs about the universe were called Walter Cronkite's Universe. One would think that the grandeur of the universe needs no assistance from Walter Cronkite. One would think wrong. CBS knows that Walter Cronkite plays better on television than the Milky Way, and Jimmy Swaggart plays better than God. For God exists only in our minds, whereas Swaggart is there to be seen, admired, adored, which is why he is the star of the show, and why Billy Graham is a celebrity, and why Oral Roberts has his own university, and why Robert Schuller has a crystal cathedral all to himself. If I am not mistaken, the word for this is blasphemy. There is a final argument that whatever criticisms may be made of televised religion, there remains the inescapable fact that it attracts viewers by the millions. This would appear to be the meaning of the statements quoted earlier by Billy Graham and Pat Robertson that there is a need for it among the multitude, to which the best reply I know was made by Hannah Arendt, who, in reflecting on the products of mass culture, wrote, "This state of affairs, which indeed is equaled nowhere else in the world, can properly be called mass culture. Its promoters are neither the masses nor their entertainers, but are those who try to entertain the masses with what once was an authentic object of culture, or to persuade them that Hamlet can be as entertaining as My Fair Lady and educational as well. The danger of mass education is precisely that it may become very entertaining indeed. There are many great authors of the past who have survived centuries of oblivion and neglect, but it is still an open question whether they will be able to survive an entertaining version of what they have to say." If we substitute the word religion for Hamlet and the phrase great religious traditions for great authors of the past, this quotation may stand as the decisive critique of televised religion. There is no doubt, in other words, that religion can be made entertaining. The question is, by doing so, do we destroy it as an authentic object of culture? And does the popularity of a religion that employs the full resources of vaudeville drive more traditional religious conceptions into manic and trivial displays? I have already referred to Cardinal O'Connor's embarrassing attempts to be well-liked and amusing, and to a parish priest who cheerfully tries to add rock music to Catholic education. I know of one rabbi who has seriously proposed to his congregation that Luciano Pavarotti be engaged to sing Kol Nidre at a Yom Kippur service. He believes that the event would fill the synagogue as never before. Who can doubt it? But as Hannah Arendt would say, that is the problem, not a solution to one. As a member of the Commission on Theology, Education, and the Electronic Media of the National Council of the Churches of Christ, I am aware of the deep concern among established Protestant religions about the tendency toward refashioning Protestant services so that they are more televisable. It is well understood at the National Council that the danger is not that religion has become the content of television shows, but that television shows may become the content of religion. Chapter 9. Reach Out and Elect Someone. In The Last Hurrah, Edwin O'Connor's fine novel about lusty party politics in Boston, Mayor Frank Skeffington tries to instruct his young nephew in the realities of political machinery. Politics, he tells him, is the greatest spectator sport in America. In 1966, Ronald Reagan used a different metaphor. Politics, he said, is just like show business. Although sports has now become a major branch of show business, it still contains elements that make Skeffington's vision of politics somewhat more encouraging than Reagan's. In any sport, the standard of excellence is well known to both the players and spectators, and an athlete's reputation rises and falls by his or her proximity to that standard. Where an athlete stands in relation to it cannot be easily disguised or faked, which means that David Garth can do very little to improve the image of an outfielder with a .218 batting average. It also means that a public opinion poll on the question, who is the best woman tennis player in the world, is meaningless. The public's opinion has nothing to do with it. Martina Navratilova's serve provides the decisive answer. One may also note that spectators at a sporting event are usually well aware of the rules of the game and the meaning of each piece of the action. There is no way for a batter who strikes out with the bases loaded to argue the spectators into believing that he has done a useful thing for his team, except perhaps by reminding them that he could have hit into a double play. The difference between hits and strikeouts, touchdowns and fumbles, aces and double faults cannot be blurred, even by the pomposities and malapropisms of a Howard Cosell. If politics were like a sporting event, there would be several virtues to attach to its name: clarity, honesty, excellence. But what virtues attach to politics if Ronald Reagan is right? Show business is not entirely without an idea of excellence, but its main business is to please the crowd, and its principal instrument is artifice. If politics is like show business, then the idea is not to pursue excellence, clarity, or honesty, but to appear as if you are, which is another matter altogether. And what the other matter is can be expressed in one word: advertising. In Joe McGinnis's book about Richard Nixon's campaign in 1968, The Selling of the President, he said much of what needs to be said about politics and advertising, both in his title and in the book, but not quite all. For though the selling of a president is an astonishing and degrading thing, it is only part of a larger point. In America, the fundamental metaphor for political discourse is the television commercial. The television commercial is the most peculiar and pervasive form of communication to issue forth from the electric plug. An American who has reached the age of 40 will have seen well over 1 million television commercials in his or her lifetime, and has close to another million to go before the first Social Security check arrives. We may safely assume, therefore, that the television commercial has profoundly influenced American habits of thought. Certainly, there is no difficulty in demonstrating that it has become an important paradigm for the structure of every type of public discourse. My major purpose here is to show how it has devastated political discourse, but there may be some value in my pointing first to its effect on commerce itself. By bringing together in compact form all of the arts of show business, music, drama, imagery, humor, celebrity, the television commercial has mounted the most serious assault on capitalist ideology since the publication of Das Kapital. To understand why, we must remind ourselves that capitalism, like science and liberal democracy, was an outgrowth of the Enlightenment. Its principal theorists, even its most prosperous practitioners, believed capitalism to be based on the idea that both buyer and seller are sufficiently mature, well-informed, and reasonable to engage in transactions of mutual self-interest. If greed was taken to be the fuel of the capitalist engine, then surely rationality was the driver. The theory states, in part, that competition in the marketplace requires that the buyer not only knows what is good for him, but also what is good. If the seller produces nothing of value as determined by a rational marketplace, then he loses out. It is the assumption of rationality among buyers that spurs competitors to become winners, and winners to keep on winning. Where it is assumed that a buyer is unable to make rational decisions, laws are passed to invalidate transactions, as, for example, those which prohibit children from making contracts. In America, there even exists in law a requirement that sellers must tell the truth about their products, for if the buyer has no protection from false claims, rational decision-making is seriously impaired. Of course, the practice of capitalism has its contradictions. Cartels and monopolies, for example, undermine the theory, but television commercials make hash of it. To take the simplest example, to be rationally considered, any claim, commercial or otherwise, must be made in language. More precisely, it must take the form of a proposition, for that is the universe of discourse from which such words as true and false come. If that universe of discourse is discarded, then the application of empirical tests, logical analysis, or any of the other instruments of reason are impotent. The move away from the use of propositions in commercial advertising began at the end of the 19th century. But it was not until the 1950s that the television commercial made linguistic discourse obsolete as the basis for product decisions. By substituting images for claims, the pictorial commercial made emotional appeal, not tests of truth, the basis of consumer decisions. The distance between rationality and advertising is now so wide that it is difficult to remember that there once existed a connection between them. Today, on television commercials, propositions are as scarce as unattractive people. The truth or falsity of an advertiser's claim is simply not an issue. A McDonald's commercial, for example, is not a series of testable, logically ordered assertions. It is a drama, a mythology, if you will, of handsome people selling, buying, and eating hamburgers, and being driven to near ecstasy by their good fortune. No claims are made, except those the viewer projects onto or infers from the drama. One can like or dislike a television commercial, of course, but one cannot refute it. Indeed, we may go this far. The television commercial is not at all about the character of products to be consumed. It is about the character of the consumers of products. Images of movie stars and famous athletes, of serene lakes and macho fishing trips, of elegant dinners and romantic interludes, of happy families packing their station wagons for a picnic in the country, these tell nothing about the products being sold. But they tell everything about the fears, fancies, and dreams of those who might buy them. What the advertiser needs to know is not what is right about the product, but what is wrong about the buyer. And so, the balance of business expenditures shifts from product research to market research. The television commercial has oriented business away from making products of value and toward making consumers feel valuable, which means that the business of business has now become pseudotherapy. The consumer is a patient assured by psychodramas. All of this would come as a great surprise to Adam Smith, just as the transformation of politics would be equally surprising to the redoubtable George Orwell. It is true, as George Steiner has remarked, that Orwell thought of newspeak as originating in part from the verbiage of commercial advertising. But when Orwell wrote in his famous essay, Politics and the English Language, that politics has become a matter of defending the indefensible, he was assuming that politics would remain a distinct, although corrupted, mode of discourse. His contempt was aimed at those politicians who would use sophisticated versions of the age-old arts of doublethink, propaganda, and deceit. That the defense of the indefensible would be conducted as a form of amusement did not occur to him. He feared the politician as deceiver, not as entertainer. The television commercial has been the chief instrument in creating the modern methods of presenting political ideas. It has accomplished this in two ways. The first is by requiring its form to be used in political campaigns. It is not necessary, I take it, to say very much about this method. Everyone has noticed and worried in varying degrees about it, including former New York City Mayor John Lindsay, who has proposed that political commercials be prohibited. Even television commentators have brought it to our attention, as, for example, Bill Moyers in The 32nd President, a documentary on his excellent television series A Walk Through the 20th Century. My own awakening to the power of the television commercial as political discourse came as a result of a personal experience of a few years back when I played a minuscule role in Ramsey Clark's Senate campaign against Jacob Javits in New York. A great believer in the traditional modes of political discourse, Clark prepared a small library of carefully articulated position papers on a variety of subjects from race relations to nuclear power to the Middle East. He filled each paper with historical background, economic and political facts, and, I thought, an enlightened sociological perspective. he might as well have drawn cartoons. In fact, Jacob Javits did draw cartoons, in a manner of speaking. If Javits had a carefully phrased position on any issue, the fact was largely unknown. He built his campaign on a series of 30-second television commercials in which he used visual imagery, in much the same way as a McDonald's commercial, to project himself as a man of experience, virtue, and piety. For all I know, Javits believed as strongly in reason as did Ramsey Clark, but he believed more strongly in retaining his seat in the Senate, and he knew full well in what century we are living. He understood that in a world of television and other visual media, political knowledge means having pictures in your head more than having words. The record will show that this insight did not fail him. He won the election by the largest plurality in New York State history, and I will not labor the commonplace that any serious candidate for high political office in America requires the services of an image manager to design the kinds of pictures that will lodge in the public's collective head. I will want to return to the implications of image politics, but it is necessary before that to discuss the second method by which the television commercial shapes political discourse. Because the television commercial is the single most voluminous form of public communication in our society, it was inevitable that Americans would accommodate themselves to the philosophy of television commercials. By accommodate, I mean that we accept them as a normal and plausible form of discourse. By philosophy, I mean that the television commercial has embedded in it certain assumptions about the nature of communication that run counter to those of other media, especially the printed word. For one thing, the commercial insists on an unprecedented brevity of expression. One may even say instancy. A 60-second commercial is prolix. 30 seconds is longer than most. 15 to 20 seconds is about average. This is a brash and startling structure for communication, since, as I remarked earlier, the commercial always addresses itself to the psychological needs of the viewer. Thus, it is not merely therapy, it is instant therapy. Indeed, it puts forward a psychological theory of unique axioms. The commercial asks us to believe that all problems are solvable, that they are solvable fast, and that they are solvable fast through the interventions of technology, techniques, and chemistry. This is, of course, a preposterous theory about the roots of discontent, and would appear so to anyone hearing or reading it. But the commercial disdains exposition, for that takes time, and invites argument. It is a very bad commercial indeed that engages the viewer in wondering about the validity of the point being made. That is why most commercials use the literary device of the pseudo-parable as a means of doing their work. Such parables as The Ring Around the Collar, The Lost Traveler's Checks, and The Phone Call from the Sun Far Away not only have irrefutable emotional power, but, like biblical parables, are unambiguously didactic. The television commercial is about products only in the sense that the story of Jonah is about the anatomy of whales, which is to say, it isn't. Which is to say further, it is about how one ought to live one's life. Moreover, commercials have the advantage of vivid visual symbols through which we may easily learn the lessons being taught. Among those lessons are that short and simple messages are preferable to long and complex ones, that drama is to be preferred over exposition, that being sold solutions is better than being confronted with questions about problems. Such beliefs would naturally have implications for our orientation to political discourse. That is to say, we may begin to accept as normal certain assumptions about the political domain that either derive from or are amplified by the television commercial. For example, a person who has seen 1 million television commercials might well believe that all political problems have fast solutions through simple measures, or ought to, or that complex language is not to be trusted, and that all problems lend themselves to theatrical expression, or that argument is in bad taste and leads only to an intolerable uncertainty. Such a person may also come to believe that it is not necessary to draw any line between politics and other forms of social life. Just as a television commercial will use an athlete, an actor, a musician, a novelist, a scientist, or a countess to speak for the virtues of a product in no way within their domain of expertise, television also frees politicians from the limited field of their own expertise. Political figures may show up anywhere, at any time, doing anything, without being thought odd, presumptuous, or in any way out of place. Which is to say, they have become assimilated into the general television culture as celebrities. Being a celebrity is quite different from being well known. Harry Truman was well known, but he was not a celebrity. Whenever the public saw him or heard him, Truman was talking politics. It takes a very rich imagination to envision Harry Truman, or for that matter, his wife, making a guest appearance on The Goldbergs or I Remember Mama. Politics and politicians had nothing to do with these shows, which people watched for amusement, not to familiarize themselves with political candidates and issues. It is difficult to say exactly when politicians began to put themselves forward intentionally as sources of amusement. In the 1950s, Senator Everett Dirksen appeared as a guest on What's My Line. When he was running for office, John F. Kennedy allowed the television cameras of Ed Murrow's Person to Person to invade his home. When he was not running for office, Richard Nixon appeared for a few seconds on Laugh-In, an hour-long comedy show based on the format of a television commercial. By the 1970s, the public had started to become accustomed to the notion that political figures were to be taken as part of the world of show business. In the 1980s came the deluge. Vice presidential candidate William Miller did a commercial for American Express. So did the star of the Watergate hearings, Senator Sam Ervin. Former President Gerald Ford joined with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger for brief roles on Dynasty. Massachusetts Governor Mike Dukakis appeared on St. Elsewhere. Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill did a stint on Cheers. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader, George McGovern, and Mayor Edward Koch hosted Saturday Night Live. Koch also played the role of a fight manager in a made-for-television movie starring James Cagney. Mrs. Nancy Reagan appeared on Different Strokes. Would anyone be surprised if Gary Hart turned up on Hill Street Blues, or if Geraldine Ferraro played a small role as a Queens housewife in a Francis Coppola film? Although it may go too far to say that the politician as celebrity has, by itself, made political parties irrelevant, there is certainly a conspicuous correlation between the rise of the former and the decline of the latter. Some readers may remember when voters barely knew who the candidate was and, in any case, were not preoccupied with his character and personal life. As a young man, I balked one November at voting for a Democratic mayoralty candidate who, it seemed to me, was both unintelligent and corrupt. What has that to do with it? My father protested. All Democratic candidates are unintelligent and corrupt. Do you want the Republicans to win? He meant to say that intelligent voters favored the party that best represented their economic interests and sociological perspective. To vote for the best man seemed to him an astounding and naive irrelevance. He never doubted that there were good men among Republicans. He merely understood that they did not speak for his class. He shared with an unfailing eye the perspective of Big Tim Sullivan, a leader of New York's Tammany Hall in its glory days. As Terrence Moran recounts in his essay Politics 1984, Sullivan was once displeased when brought the news that the vote in his precinct was 6,382 for the Democrat and 2 for the Republican. In evaluating this disappointing result, Sullivan remarked, "Sure, didn't Kelly come to me to say his wife's cousin was running on the Republican line, and didn't I, in the interests of domestic tranquility, give him leave to vote Republican? But what I want to know is, who else voted Republican?" I will not argue here the wisdom of this point of view. There may be a case for choosing the best man over party, although I know of none. The point is that television does not reveal who the best man is. In fact, television makes impossible the determination of who is better than whom. If we mean by better such things as more capable in negotiation, more imaginative in executive skill, more knowledgeable about international affairs, more understanding of the interrelations of economic systems, and so on. The reason has almost entirely to do with image, but not because politicians are preoccupied with presenting themselves in the best possible light. After all, who isn't? It is a rare and deeply disturbed person who does not wish to project a favorable image. But television gives image a bad name. For on television, the politician does not so much offer the audience an image of himself as offer himself as an image of the audience. And therein lies one of the most powerful influences of the television commercial on political discourse. To understand how image politics works on television, we may use as an entry point the well-known commercial from which this chapter takes the first half of its title. I refer to the Bell Telephone romances created by Mr. Steve Horn, in which we are urged to reach out and touch someone. The someone is usually a relative who lives in Denver or Los Angeles or Atlanta, in any case very far from where we are, and who in a good year we will be lucky to see on Thanksgiving Day. The someone used to play a daily and vital role in our lives, that is to say, used to be a member of the family. Though American culture stands vigorously opposed to the idea of family, there nonetheless still exists a residual nag that something essential to our lives is lost when we give it up. Enter Mr. Horn's commercials. These are 30-second homilies concerned to provide a new definition of intimacy in which the telephone wire will take the place of old-fashioned co-presence. Even further, these commercials intimate a new conception of family cohesion for a nation of kinsmen who have been split asunder by automobiles, jet aircraft, and other instruments of family suicide. In analyzing these commercials, Jay Rosen makes the following observation. Horn isn't interested in saying anything. He has no message to get across. His goal is not to provide information about Bell, but to somehow bring out from the broken ties of millions of American lives a feeling which might focus on the telephone. Horn does not express himself. You do not express yourself. Horn expresses you. This is the lesson of all great television commercials. They provide a slogan, a symbol, or a focus that creates for viewers a comprehensive and compelling image of themselves. In the shift from party politics to television politics, the